The opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management or staff of Radio Kingston, WKNY. AM 1490, FM 1079, Kingston, New York.
Give myself to you completely.
Good morning and welcome to the Kingston Pride Weekend episode of Nature Nuggets. I'm your host, Laurel Sutherland, and I am always delighted to follow up the airwaves after Out in the Valley, whose crew is awfully busy today, this weekend, because, of course, today and the whole weekend is Kingston Pride. Tons of events happening with the parade and festival kicking off just after this program is finished. And if you're new to the show, the purpose of this program is to deepen our understanding a bit about different parts of the more than human world that surrounds us. And this is made easier for us here, of course, because we are very fortunate living in this region to be surrounded by such a big variety of rich ecosystems and vibrant biodiversity, from the Hudson River estuary and the lowland valleys of the Hudson Valley, you know, up into the Catskill Mountains and beyond. And so as locals, we have abundant opportunities to explore and engage with nature of all different kinds. But another driving force for this show is the importance of remembering that nature is not somehow out there, somewhere in the distance, but also right here, right now. Even in Midtown Kingston, looking out at Broadway Street, and down in New York City, where our guest today, Tanasia Swift, is coming in from Brooklyn. Welcome. Thanks for being here, Tanasia. She's there, I believe.
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, good. I surprised you, threw you in early. I'm sorry about that. But I just wanted to say hello, let folks know you were there. And we'll be talking about her work with the Billion Oyster Project later in the show. So this idea that, you know, sometimes nature is out there and we have the human world and the natural world, I'm really trying to break that down a bit because we are nature, right? And we are always in nature. Literally, wherever we are, any time of year, if we slow
recording
down,
recording in progress,
if we slow down just a little bit and look slightly more closely than we otherwise may do, we will inevitably discover some fascinating creature doing something we didn't expect, or find some fleeting ecological phenomenon that hadn't been happening the day before. And so the way we do it on this show is that every week we seek out a guest to join us on the air who has some developed expertise in some corner of the natural world. So over the past 55, 56 some episodes, we've had scientists and artists, educators, conservationists, birders, outdoor adventurers of all kinds, who come on air and help share their stories and their knowledge, with the hopes that we may come away with a little deeper understanding of what we may encounter when we step outside. And then I end by saying every week, you know, we do this because people won't fight for what they don't love, and they can't love what they don't know. So we're going to kick off with the segment Who's About Town, which we do every week, which is a bit of the sort of local society pages for the more than human world. And so I take some highlights of my own observations since over the last week, each week, and then I draw from others as well. And so, you know, each week of the year has a sort of a ecological timestamp on it, right? That's totally unique, really, every day does. But, and the science of the study of this is called phenology, right? The passing of the seasons and the ecological transitions that are happening throughout the year. So this includes things like the timing of, right, the migrations of birds, which is just sort of starting to taper off now for the season, but the blooming of all different kinds of flowers, the emergence of different butterflies and other bugs, et cetera, et cetera. And every week is different than every other week if we pay attention to the changes, and then we can start to see even bigger trends and patterns in the natural world. And so, I will say, first of all, before I'm going to take a little detour, because as I mentioned, it is Pride Weekend. And so kickoff is at noon in just a couple hours at Academy Green here in kind of the uptown, midtown divide of Kingston. And then the festival goes from 1 p.m. to 7 p.m. on St. James Street, kind of clustered around Keegan Ailes and Camp Kingston, between the roundabout and Clinton. So check that out. And then tonight, there's going to be dueling big pride parties in Kingston, which is kind of amazing. There's a party called Authentic at the Unicorn Bar, and that's with the Funk Rust Brass Band. And then there's Cambia Formas happening at the Assembly. So lots of fun queer things happening in town this weekend. So returning to sort of who's about town for the more than human world, everybody, you can't really have not probably noticed, we had our first really hot days of the season this past week. And that just really feels like a major transition, right? People are taking off layers and starting to feel like festival season. Campgrounds are open. People are out after dark with t-shirts on. The vibe of the town is responding to the evolution of the season. And yesterday, I live here right in Midtown, I noticed the catalpa trees are in full bloom. And if you're not familiar with these guys, they're just an incredible tree. They're very common here. They have big, showy flowers that look almost like kind of orchid-like, you know, 3 or 4 inches long per flower. And they have big, lush green leaves. And then later in the season, and they still have last year's on, they have these like 1 foot, 2 foot long, you know, seed pods. So they're very distinctive and charismatic tree. And they look very tropical. They're actually native to the Midwest, so not technically native to right here in New York, but as things are moving around the landscape in response to the evolving climate, they are kind of a quasi-native tree. And another timestamp that you probably have seen this past week that really, you know, stands out is the cottonwood fluff is in full effect. And so this is a real hallmark of late spring, early summer. And it's a real genius seed dispersal mechanism. So when you're seeing that fluff, of course, those are seeds that are produced by the female cottonwoods, and the fluff is her, you know, brilliant adaptation to carry those seeds up to many, many, many miles. And a lot of people think that they're allergic to them, but in fact, they are not allergenic. They coincide with the male cottonwoods putting out the pollen, but also they coincide with a lot of grass blooming. And so people sometimes think they're allergic to that fluff because when they see the fluff, they're having the reaction. But those are just coinciding natural phenomenon. Okay, I also wanted to talk about, so if you are in the listening radius of this right now, and you stick your head outside, you're likely to hear a chattering in the air. And those are chimney swifts. I just walked over here a few blocks from my house, and there were hundreds and hundreds of chimney swifts just chattering all overhead. And I've talked about them on the show before because they are so cool for so many reasons. And also because they're one of the rare birds that actually has become more common in urban areas. Because the old growth trees and the different kinds of, cliffs and caves where they used to make nests have become more rare or taken away from the landscape. But meanwhile, humans have built them exactly what they need with chimneys and smokestacks all around. And this is because these little crazy birds have so surrendered themselves to the sky that they've actually lost the ability to perch. And so they can, when they need to, grasp with their little tiny kind of toenails onto a rough surface like bricks or make a perfect thing. But for most of their lives, these birds stay in the air, and they're just incredible aerial acrobats. And they are one of the fastest birds, arguably the fastest bird that we have. Of course, a peregrine falcon in a stoop dive has been clocked at like 217 miles an hour, but that's unusual. These birds will go over 100 miles an hour as a regular thing, you know, and they're just a few inches long. They call them little flying cigars. But I learned something new about these birds that I've long been fascinated with this week. One is that one of the adaptations that they have developed in order to be able to stay in the sky for weeks, sometimes maybe they think months on end without ever coming out down, is that somewhat like a dolphin, they've learned how to turn off half of their brain. And so half of their brain can sleep at one time, and then the other half sleeps at the other time, so that they're like cognitive enough to be able to maintain flight and be in the air. So that I did not know, which is pretty amazing. And then another thing, and I'm forgetting the name of this flight, because there's a word for it, but they, on a daily basis, chimney swifts are known to take a break from their regular activities and just zoom straight up 7,000, 8,000, 9,000, 10,000 feet. Anecdotally, they've been recorded up at 20,000 feet. And then they'll hang around there for a while, and then they'll come back down. And nobody really knows why they do it. It may be just because they can. I think I would do that if I could. It sounds exhilarating. But they think maybe they're checking weather patterns. Maybe they're examining landforms. I don't know. They all sound a little implausible. But I just think that's pretty neat, looking around at these tiny little birds flying over our heads, to think that they can just take a break, cruise a couple miles straight up into the, you know, lower atmosphere, and then come back down and look for some more bugs. Another bird I saw, this was just yesterday afternoon, that I wanted to mention, was a whole flock of cedar waxwings. And cedar waxwings are a perfect example of the kind of creature that you could easily overlook, but they actually are quite common and all around, because they kind of stay high in the treetops, and they have a very distinctive call, and it's a thin, high-pitched kind of c that once you grok it and you realize that's what you're hearing, you know that they're everywhere. And these birds, boy, if you get a chance to get your binoculars on one, or if you're close enough out the window, maybe of a second floor of your house, you know, they don't go for the kind of blockbuster electric color of an orange oriole or a blue, you know, indigo bunting. Instead, they go for this kind of refined elegance that is just breathtaking. I've said before, they look to me like a an old airbrushed like Chinese painting or of a bird or something. They have a little mohawk, they're one of the only birds that specializes entirely in fruit, and so they can go, you know, weeks or months at a time eating nothing but fruit. And they have these waxy tips. The reason they're called waxwings, they have actual wax deposits on their wings and also on their tail. And they're yellow. They're bright, bright yellow. It's a very particular color of yellow. But they've found that some of the cedar waxwings in northeastern U.S. have started to have those wax spots turns orange. And they've related it back and figured out that it's because of the red pigment picked up from berries of an introduced species of honeysuckle. So just another kind of amazing way, when you pull at the strings, like the interconnectedness of all, as a new non-native species of honeysuckle has taken root in our region, it has started to change the colors of some of our birds' wings, which is pretty cool. They also, interesting thing, because they eat so much fruit, sometimes that fruit, when it's on the vine or on the bush for a while, starts to turn into alcohol, right? And so it can happen where you'll see a whole flock of totally blasted cedar waxwings. They will get drunk on the fermented berries. And so the normally shy kind of birds who stay up in the treetops, you may see them kind of hanging around in your yard. And it is dangerous for them because they could be more vulnerable to predators. But basically, if you see that phenomenon, the best thing to do is just try to, you know, keep them safe and let them sober up, because once they sober up, they'll shake it off and live to fly another day. Okay, let's see. This is not my observation, but I wanted, there's another bird that I just absolutely had to share. So this is from the Hudson River Almanac, a free email from the DEC that I get every Friday, right? And it's a list of all kinds of cool fish and birds and other natural phenomenon from the region, collected and kind of curated from lots of local scientists and naturalists. But folks have been seeing a flock of, I believe, 7 black-bellied whistling ducks down on the Wallkill River. And this is a very strange bird to see appearing in New York. I actually did just see some bit over a month ago, but that's because I was in, you know, on the Gulf Coast in Texas. So these are primarily a South American bird, Central American bird, that has come up over the last 20 years into very southern tip of Florida, very southern part of Texas. But I'm going to read what All About Birds says. The black-bellied whistling duck is a boisterous duck with a brilliant pink bill and an unusual long-legged silhouette. In places like Texas and Louisiana, watch for noisy flocks of these gaudy ducks dropping into fields or loafing on golf course ponds. They really are kind of gaudy. They strike you. They have a very different vibe and look to any other ducks. And they're known as tree ducks. So they're the only ducks that are, by as a habit, they perch and nest in trees. And actually, down in Texas, not infrequently, you actually will see them all lined up on a telephone wire, like a duck that perches, you know, on a wire, like a different kind of bird. It just is very strange. But so, you know, I think the first, it says that the New York State Avian Records Committee list for the black-billed whistling duck notes that the first record that was ever accepted for a wild bird was just in May 2002 in Suffolk County. But since 2002, there have been 21 scattered sightings around New York State. So, you know, I had mentioned before seeing one of the first county records of yellow-crowned night heron last year. And then since then, there have been an increasing handful of sightings, which paints a picture of a bird that's moving north. And this is the kind of thing that we expect in a climate-changing world. So I would guess that that's what we're seeing with this tropical whistling duck, is that the things that they need are becoming more common further and further north. Also, though, they love to eat grain, and actually nocturnally, interestingly. And so it could be that, you know, agriculture and golf courses has helped them start to make that move. But who knows? In another 10 years' time, it just might be a normal thing to see black-bellied whistling ducks cruising around Hudson Valley, something I never thought I would see. All right, I've got way too many nature nuggets to go through. I want to get to our guest, so I'm going to just limit this to maybe one or two more. But one cool one that I just think is such an interesting kind of unique local phenomenon. Many folks will be familiar with the seal that we've had for many years now, who keeps coming back around the lighthouse where in the mouth of Esopus Creek, you know, in Saugerties, where it comes into the Hudson River. And this pup, this is a seal who has had quite a life journey. And I think every year people don't know if she's going to come back. But it's been 8 years now, I think, surprising people. And so this was, as a pup, a brand new pup, this is a harbor seal, was rescued in April of 2018 from Lower Goose Island in Harpswell, Maine. And then spent a period of rehabilitation at the Mystic Connecticut Aquarium Animal Rescue Center. And a white tag was that says 246 was put on her rear flipper before she was released in Charleston, Rhode Island. And Charlestown, maybe. And that was in 2019. And so following a long journey down the coast, for some reason, she took a turn and started swimming up the Hudson River. And in August of 2019, on and off through now, in June 2025, this seal has found a home at the mouth of the Esopus Creek in Saugerties, 110 miles from the ocean. So, you know, why she loves that spot and why she keeps coming back, I don't think we have any idea. But it's pretty amazing that you can have a good chance of going and seeing a harbor seal if you head over to Saugerties. Last note I'll make is just that all this rain and then the warmth has really started to pop many of our local oysters. And so in particular, people are reporting that the golden oyster mushrooms are out in abundance in certain places now. And our alternate host here and proprietor of the Chicory Naturalist, Chris Baker, has a blog that she calls the Oyster Log. And I believe she's referring to this golden oyster mushroom, which very unusual in that it's native to Eastern Russia and Northern China, but has become, as far as I know, the first non-native slash potentially invasive mushroom that we have. But it's a brilliant, bright orange mushroom that's pretty easy to identify and be certain about. And it's very good eating. It's a very nutty, savory kind of flavor, and they grow in huge profusions. And in my mind, because they aren't native, you know, harvesting them is, you know, you know, the thing I would encourage to do. And so if you go out and about and start to see some huge amounts of golden oyster mushrooms, they are very good eating. And hopefully this is auspicious that the chanterelles should also be appearing in early June. All right, with that, I'm going to take a quick moment to hear some words from our community.
Hi, I'm Desiree Lyle, board member at Taproot Community Land Trust. Taproot CLT, a nonprofit organization serving Ulster County whose goal is to provide permanently affordable housing. Because this movement must be led and advocated for by community members, we invite you to join Taproot to help advance our vision to provide long-term affordable housing for folks in and around Kingston. Opportunities include the Community Outreach Committee to develop and implement Taproot's communication strategy, the Operations Committee, responsible for day-to-day operations, and the Portfolio Expansion Committee to help bring new homes into Taproot's portfolio and oversee the home buying process for potential Taproot homeowners. And as Taproot continues to grow, we are looking for passionate and experienced community members to join our board of directors. To find out more, click Get Involved at taprootclt.org.
Despierta, Kingston!
Despierta, Kingston!
Despierta, Kingston!
Despierta, Kingston!
5 de la mañana.
Despierta!
Despierta, Boricua!
Hi, I'm Elba Perez-Becker. Let's start the day together, weekdays from 5 to 6 in the morning on Despierta, Kingston. You'll hear everything that you need to know before you leave home or on your way to work in Spanish. And if you miss a live, it's on the Radio Kingston archive right after the show.
Despierta la vida, hoy es un nuevo día, el tiempo y su reloj, cuida tu corazón.
Despierta
a un horizonte de luz.
Despierta.
Si oye el río cantar,
despierta.
Y el fuego me guiará.
Despierta.
A lo bueno.
Despierta, Kingston. Weekdays, 5 in the morning on Radio Kingston. AM 1490, FM 1079, or anytime at radiokingston.org.
Rotary Club of Kingston is hosting the annual Mutt Strut at Kingston Point Beach tomorrow afternoon. This is a day to celebrate dogs and the people who love them. There will be a dog show at 1:30 p.m. Proceeds from the event will benefit the Ulster County SPCA and the Rotary Club's community projects. Mutt Strut, tomorrow from noon to 3 p.m. at Kingston Point Beach. For more information, kingstonnyrotary.org. Welcome back. You are listening to Nature Nuggets. I'm your host, Laurel Sutherland, and I am delighted to turn our conversation now towards the Billion Oyster Project and to welcome our guest today, Tanasia Swift. Thank you so much for being here, Tanasia.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited, and this is probably my first time being on live radio, so super exciting, so thank you.
Oh, excellent. Well, I'm glad to hear that. Tanasia is an urban environmental educator and leader, scuba diver, and proud Brooklyn native, working at the intersection of climate justice, education, and marine restoration. As the Assistant Director of Community Engagement at Billion Oyster Project, she leads programs that connect New Yorkers to the waterfront and cultivate partnerships across the city's diverse communities. With over a decade of experience in environmental education and project management, she's developed citywide programs, trained field educators, and contributed to oyster reef restoration, both above and below the waterline. Tanasia is a certified PADI rescue diver, a Women's Divers Hall of Fame associate, and a passionate advocate for community science. And when she's not building reef programs or mentoring new environmentalists, she's exploring New York City's local waters. Excellent. Well, Tanasia, I'm hoping, so I had told you before we came on, that when I first came to Brooklyn 7 some years ago, I was so inspired and intrigued when I first learned about the Billion Oyster Project. So it's been years in the making. I'm so excited to have you on the air with us here today. I just think it's such a fascinating project that's so just cool for so many reasons. But I, you know, this is a bit far afield from our, you know, we are on the tidal Hudson Estuary here up in Kingston, but obviously we're, you know, more in the freshwater part. And so I'm wondering if you can start us off with a little kind of context setting and just a little, paint us a little bit of a picture of how, what was, you know, 400 years ago or something, what was the role of oysters in New York and what kind of role did they play in sort of the development of the early city?
Yeah, so even before we think about New York City as a city, The land that we are on now was mostly inhabited by the Lenape, so the first people who were here in what we now know as New York City. And so imagine New York City without the buildings, without the busy streets, without the subways, but instead it's forest, it's wetlands, it's streams meandering into the Hudson River. And that's exactly what we were dealing with in terms of this landscape. I'm not sure if it's okay, but I just wanted to plug. I know there's a project called the Wallachia Project that speaks about and has great visuals of what the city used to look like before, you know, we started to build along the waterfront and throughout the city. And that was put together by like the New York Botanical Garden and an ecologist who also has developed a part of these visuals in terms of like you see this lush green forest and these streams, and now you can see the comparison to like really busy streets. And there were so much wildlife just around the coast, from huge mammals, you know, like you have beavers and you had deer and bear, and oysters a part of that picture as well. And so oysters were and always have been a huge part of the city's culture. It's like one of the things that's weaved into what we consider as New York City. And so the Lenape, as mentioned, were the first inhabitants, and they played a huge role in kind of like what we now know as how people used to engage with oysters. So oysters were big in New York. It was New York City at one point was considered the big oyster, because there were so many oysters. Over 200,000 acres of oyster reefs have been lost. And that's like about the size. If we were to take like Staten Island, multiplying that by 7, that's how many acres of oyster reefs we've lost. And then eventually we lost lots of those populations, which we can go into a little bit more, which is how Bayne Oyster Project sort of began to develop as we saw a need for this, you know, species, the oyster, to come back to New York.
Wow, thank you. And I wonder, I love that you brought up that project, but it might have been hard for listeners to grab onto if people wanted to see those images you were talking about and that visualization of New York before colonization. How could folks do that?
Yeah, it's the Wallachia Project. So the New York Botanical Garden, it's a visual, it's on the internet. You can sort of like look, Google like Wallachia, or even the name Eric Sanderson, and more than likely, or Manhattan, any of those keywords, it'll pop up. And it has this map, this visual that has New York City before colonialization and what it is currently. And it shows you what it looks like and also goes into some of the species on land and in water and in the sky, of course, that used to inhabit the city. So it's a great resource if you're interested in. And I think they just expanded. Initially, the map only showed parts of Manhattan. And now they've expanded, I believe, this year to show other parts of New York City as well. So
I appreciate that you brought that up. The book Manhattan was gifted to me when I was moving to New York for the first time, and it just really helped my imagination walking through the streets to see, you know, deeper than the pavement and really, you know, what still is here, but obviously what was here. Wow, I really appreciate you bringing that up. The 200,000 acres, and that's what I was hoping to get, kind of help set the stage here for just the scale. I mean, I read somewhere, I can't back this up, but I read somewhere that New York Harbor was the largest concentration of oyster reefs in the world at the time that, you know, and so, but that kind of scale. So they were a major, major part of the ecology and actually the infrastructure. So I wonder if you could talk about, you know, what was the ecological role of oyster beds and why are they important?
So oysters are a keystone species, and we consider them a keystone species because they help to really bolster the life of other organisms and species around it. So without the oyster, there are sort of like this chain reaction of many aquatic species not having homes or food sources for that reason. The executive director of Bayne Oyster Project has this great analogy of if you imagine a forest without trees, you can imagine how many like species will be impacted by that. And it's very similar when you think about oysters. So at the bottom of the harbor, having oyster reefs, they do three essential ecological things for the environment. And one of them I alluded to before, but creating habitat for fish and other critters. So fish like to hide in oyster reefs. They use the reefs as nurseries for their young. They sometimes eat oysters. So creating habitat is one of those ecological features. Then you have oysters with the ability to filter water. So oysters are natural filter feeders. So one adult oyster being able to filter about 50 gallons of water within a day. Wow. So imagine an entire reef of oysters doing that same thing. We're cycling water through the oyster. So they're cleaning the water, for lack of better terms. And also, oyster reefs have the ability to help to buffer wave energy. So they're protecting shorelines. So a reef that is large enough, and of course, you know, thinking about some of the other natural barriers can help protect the cities around New York and around other coastal cities. So they have those three ecological functions. So reef habitat, filtering of water, protection of shorelines. But there is a fourth that I love to mention, and that's just the culture. So oysters have brought people together, many walks of life for many years. Thinking about it historically from the Lenape consuming and harvesting oysters to then the Dutch and the English, you know, harvesting oysters. As you mentioned, oysters basically being such a huge staple in New York City. Everyone at some point ate oysters, from the rich to the poor. So you had oyster carts. You can think of it as like a local fast food to some degree. So creating jobs along the waterfront, many people eating oysters, regardless of your race, your economic background, even now people coming together, students and community members with the Bay and Oyster Project to install oyster reefs into the waters. So they have this cultural aspect of bringing people to the waterfront. The way that they've done it for years have been different, but those are the four important things that I think of when I think of oysters.
Awesome. Thank you so much for that. Yeah, I think sometimes, you know, until being explained to, you know, people can't appreciate just the massive role they played, right? The infrastructure you're talking about, you know, actually buffering hurricane force, surf, and then providing all of those nooks and crannies and, you know, for nurseries for so many different other species of fish. So I guess some of the, you know, not to be too obvious of a question, but given all those, you know, roles and important contributions, you know, what have been some of the consequences? Because obviously, right, we've seen a massive die-off over the century. So I guess maybe, first of all, backing up a little bit, you know, why, what happened, and then what have been some of the consequences that have resulted?
Yeah, so New York City, going from that visual that I painted in the beginning, from a really like lush waterfront with marshes and forest, eventually we began to dredge out many of those smaller, shallow streams so that boats can get closer into land. We began to build on the wetlands themselves, paving out roads and damaging a lot of the habitat that once was here. And then eventually, as more people began to settle around the New York City shoreline, and oysters were one of the key species that were harvested, we began to really exploit the oyster to the point where their populations began to decline. So directly through over-harvesting, so overfishing, so pulling out many of the species before they're able to repopulate fast enough. And then also lots of damage just to the natural waterfront, from dredging to building along the waterfront, has been some of the major challenges to why the oyster has declined. And then eventually, with more people living in a really condensed area, pollution. So thinking about, like, where do you put all of the pollution from human waste to trash that we are developing? And at that time, the easiest thing was to put it into the water. So those three things kind of contributed to the decline of the oyster. So over-harvesting, dredging and development along the water, and additionally, pollution. Yeah. So with that said, it got to the point where one, people were getting sick from eating the little oysters that were left. And when we also realized that there weren't many left, there was a ban on consuming oysters at some point.
Gotcha. Well, one of the things that I've first loved, and there are many about the Billion Oyster Project, is just that the vision is contained right there in the name. It says, you know, it's a very aspirational but specific, you know, vision. And so maybe let us know a little bit about how Billion Oyster Project got started and what is that vision?
So Billion Oyster Project, we started in 2014. And it's amazing. I didn't mention this in my bio, but one of the reasons why Billion Oyster Project exists today is because of a local New York Harbor high school, which is the New York Harbor School. So the New York Harbor School, just to plug in there, is a public high school where students focus on different maritime careers related to the harbor. So students are learning things from aquaculture to marine biology research, to professional scuba diving, vessel operations, and there are a number of programs within the Harbor School that students can participate in. And it's a public high school, so it's a free high school. Students would apply for it, you know, in their while they're in middle school. And New York Harbor School was this high school that I also attended in my younger years, but eventually, we had what's considered a career and technical education program. So those programs that I just mentioned earlier, some people like to think of them as trades, but the students are on the track to specialize in this maritime trade. And aquaculture was one of those programs, one of the CTE career and technical education programs. And the founder of the Harbor School, Murray Fisher, who is one of my mentors, I contribute in, you know, just give him so much respect for the work that he's done. So Murray Fisher and the aquaculture teacher at the time, Pete Malinowski, who is the current executive director of Billion Oyster Project, both were realizing how impactful it was to have students doing restoration in the harbor at a small scale. Seeing the joy, and it brings me back to the quote that you mentioned at the top, thinking about people's connections to natural spaces. How do you get people to care about those natural spaces? And then also getting them to know about those natural spaces in a way that they're going to want to become stewards. And so Pete and Murray were realizing that, you know, if we were to take this model of having students do real world work around New York City, and then expanding that opportunity to other students around the city and community members, this could really be a huge turning point, shifting the dynamic of how urban students sort of like interact with the waters around New York City. And so from there, Billion Oyster Project was birthed out of the Harbor School's aquaculture program. And so our mission is to restore oyster reefs to the New York Harbor, but a lot of that is also through public education initiatives, because we know restoration without education and community engagement is, you know, not as impactful. So that is how the Billion Oyster Project, the short end of how the Billion Oyster Project came to be.
Wow, it's so amazing on so many levels. And I have so many questions, but I guess just continuing the momentum you're on right there. So how do things stand? You know, I guess, first of all, actually, let me back up. So that's about the kind of the origin. So what does it look like in practice? You know, and is a billion oysters a literal, you know, aspiration? And then what is the process that you get oysters back in the water?
Yeah, billion oysters is quite literal. We are trying to plant 1 billion oysters in the New York Harbor by 2035. And it takes many players to make that happen. A billion oysters is a huge feat when you think about it. And so you have not only the staff at Billion Oyster Project, so we have folks who specialize in restoration, folks who specialize in education, developing curriculum, folks who specialize in community engagement, outdoor education. We have those who are doing scuba diving. We have those who are on our finance team. And so that's like the internal part of it. But the external part of it is, you know, we require lots of additional hands outside of our staff. So from volunteers to those schools that I mentioned and community groups. And all of these different people come together and they play a role in the work that we do. So if I were to put it, it's not a linear process, but if I were to try to put this in terms of how do you get to installing reefs and make that process work, I'll try to explain it as linear as possible. Is you'll have a team of folks who are out developing, so a design, okay, we want to plant an oyster reef in this location in the harbor. Then we'll have a team of folks who are set on developing permits. So we have to go through a permit process to get approvals from the proper regulatory agencies. So whether that is New York State Department of Environment Conservation or the landowner, we have our folks who are doing the permitting. Then we have the team of folks who are out there finding funding for those reefs. So we'll have a team of folks who are trying to find funding to have a reef installed. And then we have a team of folks who are working on curriculum for this reef. So here is a little information and some, you know, lesson plans that teachers can use in the classrooms. And then once all of those things are, and of course, community members who are, some of them are the ones who really want to have oyster reefs in their backyards. So we're coming together thinking about the design of what this reef could look like. And then once we get the go flag and we're ready to go on that, essentially, we'll start off with spawning or setting oysters in our hatchery. So oysters are set in our hatchery. So we'll start off with that process. And even before that, I should have taken a step back. We have a shell recycling program.
Yeah.
So restaurants around New York City, normally, if they're selling shellfish, they would dispose of those shells into the trash.
Sure.
And would never see them again. But we recycle those shells and use them for our projects as well. So we'll take shells, we'll place them into a large container where water is pumped from the harbor. We'll introduce that tank. You think of it as a big pool of harbor water with oyster shells inside of structures inside of them. We'll pump in oyster larvae into that big pool. Eventually, the oyster is free swimming for about a couple of weeks up to a month. And then they'll settle onto the shells. And then when they're ready, you can literally pull out a shell with baby oysters, what we call spat, on them. And then you'll have a team of folks who do what's called spat counts. So they're literally counting every singular baby oyster on that shell so that we can get an estimate of how many oysters are in this set before they go out to the site. And we're ready for installation about 2 months out from when the oysters were placed into this tank. And then that's when the community comes in, where we'll have community members join us and installing these reefs at various sites. We also have, as mentioned, volunteers who are helping to build these cages. So they're building cages, cleaning shells. And then when you're ready, the oysters are ready to be installed. Community members are right there alongside us. In addition to sometimes we have school groups come out. And then after, you know, that oyster reef is in water, students are coming out, they're learning about the oysters, they're seeing them grow from really small specks of what looks like pepper to now adult oysters. So it's a much more complex,
yeah,
sort of dynamic, but so many players are involved in that, and our landowners as well, like getting approval from landowners. So many players that go into making the Bay and Oyster Project become a well-oiled machine.
Thank you for laying that out for us. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Nature Nuggets. I'm your host, Laurel Sutherland, and we're talking with Tanasia Swift with the Billion Oyster Project, who is laying out this just incredible, you know, visionary process of engaging students and community members and restaurants. And I'm guessing there's also got to be a lot of politics to get permission for the sites where you establish these reefs to bring oysters back. So one question, I have a lot of questions we're not going to have time for, but I guess one question is, how are they doing? You know, you kind of laid out for us, you know, why the oysters were pushed out in the first place with pollution and dredging and habitat loss. So I'm curious, I know that the water quality, hopefully in the Hudson River and in the New York Harbor, is better than it was 50 years ago. We have the Clean Water Act and other things that have really helped that. But are these oysters able to thrive in the conditions that are currently there?
Yeah, that's a great question. So of course, it's quite tough when you think about all of the challenges when it comes to restoration. I will mention one of the successes in terms of oysters in the harbor is that we are now seeing a larger population of wild oysters sprung about throughout various places in the harbor. Mm. And so when we say wild oysters, we're talking about the oysters that Bay and Oyster Project has not directly placed in the water. So we'll go to a site, we'll see that there are oysters attached to things like rocks and pilings and just along the waterfront, just like watching them and seeing where they are. And sometimes these are places that we don't even have oyster reefs and they're naturally occurring. So this boom of wild oysters around the harbor is one success that comes with doing oyster restoration. And of course, there are some of those challenges when it comes to pollution. Pollution is still a huge challenge in New York City's waters because we have what's called combined sewer overflow. So most of the water that comes from our homes and from the sewers, they normally, that water is treated at a facility. But sometimes if there's heavy rain and the waste treatment facility does not have space to treat the water, it gets dumped directly into the harbor. So we're still dealing with some of those issues, but despite that, you're seeing better water quality and some of the habitats of oysters begin to blossom a bit more.
Yeah, well, that's encouraging. You know, there's so many facets of this program that are so wonderful, you know, giving urban students the chance to have hands-on experiences with the natural world and then, you know, engaging, diners and regular, residents in the process of community science. And then, of course, the actual benefits of biodiversity. All kinds of creatures, as you mentioned, depend on the physical structure of oyster reefs in order to when they're small, stay safe from predators. And so this is, it's very encouraging. I was going to mention, so, if you've been a longtime listener of Nature Nuggets, this is episode 55, I think, right now. But episode 25, we had some filmmakers on. They had a film that's a really beautiful. It's an incredible film called Holding Back the Tide. And it's ostensibly a documentary about oysters in New York City, and it is that. But it also kind of frames oysters into this kind of queer cultural icon and does so really masterfully. And, so much of what you're doing, it's logistical and it's scientific and it's educational, but there's also a real mythos to it. It's a very, that the role of storytelling and visionary kind of thinking embedded in this project, I think, gives it so much juice. This idea that to resurrect, this ecosystem. And I also see that, most people, different places are, but New Yorkers have a lot of pride. There's a lot of pride to be a New Yorker. Yeah. And so I've always wanted to, if we could expand that pride to, oysters are New Yorkers too, kind of a thing. That that this is something that's part of the identity of New York, that people, as I say, every single show, as you mentioned, people won't fight for what they don't love and they can't love what they don't know. And so it feels to me like this project in and of itself is so critically important, just about the oysters, but along the way, it's tapping into the imagination of people, belonging to the more than human world and stewarding it. And that might be, the ripple effects of that are at least as important, if harder to measure. I'm guessing that, I know they're filter feeders, which you said 51 oyster can clean 50 gallons of water in a day. And so, right, you magnify that, a billion oysters could clean New York Harbor, basically, is part of that vision, right?
Yeah. That's the thinking about it. Like, that's what is said, a billion oysters can filter in the standing body of water in one day. So thinking about the fact that New York Harbor, of course, the water moves, right, from the ocean, and all of our oceans are connected. But if that water was sort of like a tub and oysters are filtering, that is the idea, is that a billion oysters could filter the standing water of the harbor in a day.
Wow, that's extraordinary. And of course, because they are filter feeders and because we are still talking about New York Harbor, it'll probably be a very long time till we're eating oysters again out of New York Harbor. Is that right?
That's correct. I think a part of that is also thinking about the current issue of our sewer systems, which are just ancient at this point. We have sewer systems that are not equipped. And I know it's being worked on currently, but until the issue of pollution being dumped directly into the harbor is resolved, that will remain an issue for us being able to consume any of the oysters that are in the harbor.
Yeah. Well, that's understandable. All right, well, we're going to take an opportunity to hear some more words from our community, and then we're going to come back into this great conversation.
This is a Pride moment from Radio Kingston.
Well, you know, I come from the old days. There were about usually three or four gay bars in town, in New York, because it's in Manhattan. When police came in and inspected periodically, and if anybody was sitting too close, you had to separate immediately. And actually, there was a system in one of the places where the lights would blink. So you stopped dancing in the back room together, and the police would then come in and inspect. If you were a man, quote-unquote man, allowed to wear six items of women's clothing, a certain number. If you had more than that, they took you in to jail.
This has been a Pride moment from Radio Kingston.
Hi, this is Lorraine from the Kingston Farmers Market. We're open every Saturday from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. in the county courthouse parking lot. The market is bigger than ever this year, with over 80 vendors this season. We have all of your favorite vendors with fruit, vegetables, eggs, meat, fish, cheese, and plenty of new ones, too, with live music every week, community groups, and seasonal events. Our Pop Bucks program lets kids try new veggies. We accept SNAP and offer Fresh Connect checks. Find us at the info booth to find out more. That's the Kingston Farmers Market in the county courthouse parking lot, uptown, Saturdays, 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. Check us out on Facebook and Instagram to stay up to date on everything the market has to offer. Or visit us online at kingstonfarmersmarket.org.
Greetings, blessings, and salutations. And I'm inviting you to the Miss V Show, the musical journey for your soul, on Saturday nights from 8 to 10 p.m.
Show me love.
You are love, you are loving, and you are lovable. Take a break for love.
Now that I am love.
Now that I am love. Love is you.
Saturday Night Love on Radio Kingston. 1490 AM, 107.9 FM, and anytime on radiokingston.org.
Welcome back to Nature Nuggets. Yeah, I'm your host, Laurel Sutherland, and we've been having a wonderful conversation with Dinesha Swift of the Billion Oyster Project. And if you have just caught a little piece of this conversation and you're interested in hearing the whole thing, this show will be archived by tomorrow, as well as all of our 55 now episodes are all archived, and you can listen to it like a podcast. That's under Nature Nuggets at radiokingston.org. Also, if you want to kind of stay in touch more regularly, we do have a growing Instagram presence. The handle there is at HV Nature Nuggets. So we put up the shows, but also different observations and curiosities throughout the week. And then finally, if you want to contact the show directly, if you have a guest that you'd like to see on the show or a burning question about the natural world we may be able to answer on air, you can write us directly, naturenuggets at radiokingston.org. So we've just got a few minutes left, Dinesha, and I just love the picture that you've painted for us of you know, the work of the Billion Oyster Project. It's so brilliant and rooted, the way it's rooted in community and in science, but also in kind of this vision of stewarding a new world of healthy ecological systems, all about it. And I'm wondering, first of all, just to make sure, if folks want to learn more or maybe get involved and even get their feet wet, what would be the best ways for them to do that?
Yeah, so if you're interested in just learning more about Billion Oyster Project, our website is probably the go-to place where you can learn more about what we do, sign up for volunteer days, read more about our reefs. And so our website is billionoysterproject.org. And there are many opportunities, whether you're an educator, you're a community scientist, you are just looking for a volunteer event you want to visit one of our reefs with the group. So many opportunities for you to participate, or if you just like eating oysters and want to join one of our restaurant partners and helping us to recycle those shells by eating those oysters, many ways to get involved that way. So beingoysterproject.org.
Excellent. Thank you. And we could talk about oysters for hours more, but something I came across looking at your website was this, it's so cool, this New York Harbor Estuary Species Identification Guide, which looks like you collaborated. The art is beautiful. It's each species is drawn just scientifically accurate, but also just artistically vibrant and beautiful. And I wondered, you know, you've spent a lot of time in the water, and I'm curious about, you know, maybe some of your most unlikely encounters, or just if there's species that, you know, that you are aware of because you do this work that people might just not even know are surrounding them in New York Harbor.
Yeah, definitely. I think the first one that comes to mind is the seahorse.
Yeah.
So seahorse are in New York City's waters. We find them in Brooklyn. We find them in oyster cages. And we're more commonly starting to see them. And that's just a huge, huge, just a excitement for many people, even adults, even myself. I get excited about seeing seahorse.
Yeah.
And then another species that we don't quite find as often, but I know that there are so many here, starfish.
Mm.
Through diving mostly, I've seen many starfish at certain sites. But those are two species that are living in New York City's waters that you may not realize are actually here. And the fact that students are able to pull up a cage and find seahorse is just, it's a gift without even being able to give it.
Yeah.
That
was absolutely shock to me. We found one perfectly intact, little dried on the beach at Fire Island. And it just seemed like just mystical, kind of like, where did this, creature come from? Well, and then also, you know, it's incredible to be seeing these photos that people are taking of whales and dolphins in the East River, or, you know, against the skyline of Manhattan, which seems to be a clear indication of something good going on, whether it's the water quality or food sources that have increased. But that seems to be a clear trend in a positive direction as well, right?
Yeah, definitely. When I speak to anyone and I'm giving my elevator pitch about why folks should participate in harbor restoration, I usually use the example of dolphins and whales coming back to New York City, because people are always amazed by how large dolphins and whales are. That's like the entryway to so much more. And so the fact that all of these pieces, from water quality to food availability to harbor restoration, are working together, and people are, you know, making this happen, it's amazing to see that these animals are coming back to the harbor.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so important. These can be just the deluge of distressing, you know, news that we get in our news feeds now. It can be pretty overwhelming to the point of just paralysis, any given day. And so to have a project like this, but also, you know, a legitimate trend where animals are coming back. I mean, you said the seahorses are more common now than they were before. You know, it's the kind of story that can really hook people to get involved. And, you know, we are an urban society already, but we're getting more and more urban. And so, you know, having urban people have an ecological education, and having urban designers and placemakers incorporating ecological priorities into the trees that are planted and into the decisions that are made is critically important, of course, for the creatures and for biodiversity, but also for ourselves.
Yes.
You know, the mental health of little kids and of adults, you know, that the science is getting better at showing the direct correlation between how far from a green space you are and what kind of indicators of mental health that you record. So it's just, you're doing the good work, engaging so many people and really getting people, you know, yes, educated, but also just, you know, experientially inspired and involved. So huge thanks for that. And I wonder if you have, and you kind of mentioned how people could get involved, but, you know, kind of like events or, publicly available offerings that you might be able to highlight in our final 30 seconds.
Yeah, we definitely have couple of volunteer events that happen on the weekends and at the end of the weeks that folks can participate in. We have beach cleanups that happen in Coney Island. And then eventually we have in September a big fundraising party called the Billion Oyster Party. So you have an opportunity to eat as many oysters as you can eat. And it's a fun event. It happens every year. And this year is going to be on September 25th. Billion Oyster Party.
Okay, awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time, Tanasia. We're getting cut off here, but appreciate all your work. Take care.
Thank you.
Yeah, wildlife, I give myself to you. Complete.